Hi, my name is Shirley, and I'm an alcoholic. Oh, that sounds great. I like that. I'd like to welcome you all here today, and if we could start things out with a moment of silence, of gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 75 years. Woo! Thank you. Okay. Our topic is one day at a time. And, you know, certainly it's the basis for how we live our lives today. But I can tell you, from my standpoint, it was how I used to live yesterday. If I can just get through today. You know, it's a whole new concept now. It's like get through a day today. You know, I get to live a day today. Rather than that, dear God, just let me get through this one. You know, hope this one ends. Hope it's over with soon. You know, so we've got three speakers today who will share their experience, strength, and hope with us and talk about one day at a time. And out of respect for them and respect for the other people in the audience, I'd like to ask you all to take just a moment, turn off your cell phones, beepers, watches, anything that makes a squeak or a holler, and give them the respect that they deserve at the microphone. And we'll start with my new friend on the end. That was one of the phones. If you could just turn, that's a reminder. You may not think yours is the one that's going to ring, but it will be, you know. Our first speaker is from New York. Would you please welcome Yisrael.
I'm an alcoholic and a member of the Atlantic Group, and my name is Yisrael Campbell. Hi, Yisrael. I tell you my home group so that you know that I have one. I tell you my last name in case I get run over by a car here in San Antonio. And you want to visit me in the hospital, you'll need to know my last name. I want to thank my wife, Avital, who joined me for this weekend, who's not an alcoholic, and our son, Yonah Dov Melech, who's here. Avital's just been walking around going, everyone's wearing a blue bag. You know, everyone's wearing a green lanyard. It's just amazed at this. As the few civilians of San Antonio are probably thinking the same things. In the same loving terms. So glad they could walk on my sidewalks with me today. So slowly. I'm honored to be here. I must admit, I've been sober since the 14th of February, 1980. I celebrated 30 years of continuous sobriety. I'm a sick man. Another member of our group is speaking here, and he's speaking in a hall. I'm speaking in a room. Room is definitively smaller than hall. I wrote the guy, Rick Walker, if he really exists. I said, how many seats are in room 103? He wrote back 900. But I need to know that stuff, because I'm... 30 years is no guarantee of anything. Except that my mind works better and faster and more quickly. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in early February of 1980. And my friend Ken is here, and Brianna. It's just amazing. It's amazing to be... I saw you come in. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in early February, actually on the 5th of February. I had had a hit-and-run accident the night before with a Catholic priest. Now, you're looking at me, you're thinking, whoa... You're thinking Inquisition, you know, Crusades, you know. No, I was an Irish-Italian Catholic kid from Philadelphia. My mother's Italian, my father's Irish. I was Catholic. I'd been raised Catholic. I was a student at Archbishop John Carroll High School for boys. I crashed my mom's 71 orange duster into a Catholic priest. It was hit and run. I ran. I hit, I ran. I did everything that night. He found me. He caught me. He didn't report me. And the next morning I woke up, I threw up on a school bus, I almost threw up on a school bus. I didn't smoke pot on the way to school that day because I once seen someone throw up on a school bus, and it's not a pretty sight. And I got to school, and I threw up in the hallway, which is not allowed in Catholic boys' school, and I decided to go home, and I saw my friend Jimmy, and I said, Jimmy, do you have anything at all? I'd really been committed to sobriety on the bus. And I saw Jimmy, and I said, anything. I said, I only have a little, and I need it for me. And I resented him for years. When I learned about lower companions, I thought, there's a lower companion. And I saw him at a reunion 10 or 15 years later. I was 10 or 15 years sober. And I reminded him of that night. He says, oh, I remember that. He says, I wonder if you would have gotten sober if I had given you anything that morning. He saw it completely differently than I did. He saw himself as an important first step in my recovery from alcoholism. You know, that's the twisted mind of the alcoholic. You know, I picked up my first drink when I was 9 years old. I drank for 7 years. Had I known I was going to live this long and be sober this long, I would have drank more. There are certain things I wish I had done. I would like to tell you I'm a bank robber. I would like to tell you I punched a cop. I never did anything like that. I was terrified. I was terrified before I picked up a drink. I picked up a drink to answer that fear, that just gut-level fear. And for one drink, or for two drinks, or for a certain number of drinks, that fear would subside. And then I would have one too many drinks, and I would start to lose control, and that fear would come back. And it was a constant dance and battle with trying to get rid of that fear, trying to get rid of that loneliness and that pain. And that's the way I drank. And I used drugs because they were quite honestly easier to get. I grew up in Philadelphia. I grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And to buy liquor, you had to be 21. You had to have a liquor control board card. You had to, you know, it was harder to get than a driver's license. To buy drugs, all you had to do was go to school. Right? You buy the right drugs, you don't need your lunch money. And there I was, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I drank for as long as I thought I could possibly drink. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in early February of 1980, and I stayed. I got sober. I got a sponsor. A guy named Paul P. Paul used to say, he was at the end of every conversation, I'd call him every night. You know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to tell you, I came in the afternoon of, and a little clubhouse called the 319 Clubhouse. It was on the second floor. It was caked with 45 years of tar and nicotine dripping off the walls. It looked like the inside of a cave. And there were posters on the walls at odd angles down the walls. Stupid things like think, and one day at a time. And, you know, all the things that we think are profound. And in the back and on window shades. That's what those things are, you know, that we put the steps and the traditions on. They're window shades. If you pull them like this, they go back up. You find me another organization in the world that puts its most important principles on a window shade. You find me a synagogue or church that has the Ten Commandments on a window shade. You find me a courthouse that has the Constitution on a window shade. Oh, gone. No run. No need to worry about that anymore. And in the back, in green Gothic backlit lettering, it said, but for the grace of God. And I thought, but for the grace of God, what? I would have gotten hit by a bus on my way in here. And a bunch of people gave me their phone numbers, and a bunch of people said that, you know, I should call them. And some said, call any time, and some underlined that and put an exclamation point. And I do that. I give out cards. I write, call any time. I put an exclamation point to show I really mean it. I underline it to say any time, because you know why? You know why you can do that? Because he's never going to call. And if he calls, it's not going to be any time. He's going to call when he thinks you're not there. 2 in the afternoon, 6 in the evening, never at 2. I drank so I wouldn't have to call you at 2 o'clock in the morning. And tell you what, I'm a horrible human being. I'm just, everything is wrong about me. I'm a liar, a cheat, and a thief. What am I going to tell you? And a stranger on top of that? Sorry, I'd rather beat myself with a baseball bat. I'm not going to do that. One guy, this guy Paul, took my number, and he called me the next day and said, you want to go to a meeting? I said, yeah, I don't want to go to a meeting. But I say yes, because that's what I say. 6 people called, I would have said yes to every single one of them. First one that gets there gets me. I'm not going to say no, that's confrontational. Picks me up, he takes to a meeting, they pay all the young people's group. I caught alcoholism at that meeting. I came down with alcoholism at that meeting, and some nights later, Paul became my sponsor, and I used him as a sponsor for a period of time. He used to, at the end of every conversation, he used to say, don't drink and go to meetings. And I thought, man, I got the one brilliant guy. I mean, look around. There's some lugs here. I got the brilliant guy. And then one day he said, don't drink, go to meetings and pray. And I stopped calling. I'm not right with God. I'm not anywhere near right with God. I don't know anyone that's right with God. My mother was in the convent. She hates God. What time is it now? Wow. 9 minutes. My mother was in the convent after college. She hates God. She hates the church. She hates everything. So she sent me there. I this is a replacement. The New Yorker needs 2 interpreters. At the same time. And so I came down calling synonymous, and what can I tell you? I mean, I am 30 years sober, right? That's like, that's a miracle. If I were still sitting at the 319 Club, and I had a mug that said, Chris, slashed out Israel, and a stack of cookies, and that's all I had done, that would be a miracle. I mean, just for a second, just go with me just for a second, because we don't have a lot of time, that we live in the 75 years of recorded history that Alcoholics Anonymous has existed. You know how many people lived outside of that tiny little window where people recovered from our disease? Whether it's true or not, Noah gets off the boat, right? I'm not saying it's true. I'm just saying that people have been telling this story for a long time. He saves the entire world, all the animals and his family. You know what he did when he got off the boat? Got drunk and got naked in front of his kids. Is that not alcoholism? That's my kind of alcoholism. That's not like, oops, I traded at 53 instead of 52.50. No, get naked and drunk in front of the kids, man. That's alcoholism. Now, we live in this 75-year period, so if all I had ever done was been able to stop drinking for one single day, which I wasn't able to do on the 14th or the 13th or the 12th of February, then that would be amazing and a miracle. But that's just the beginning. This book, it talks about about crossing back the bridge to crossing the bridge back to life, or perhaps in some of our cases, crossing the bridge to life for the first time. I mean, I can only tell you the details, but the details are pretty startling. So I'm 16 years old. My name is Chris Campbell. I live in Philadelphia. I'm a junior at Archbishop John Carroll High School. I'm an Irish-Italian Catholic kid from Philadelphia. 30 years later, my name is Yisrael Ben Avraham, if we want to use my Hebrew name. I live in Jerusalem. I'm an Orthodox Jew. How do you get there? Like, did I go to Father Brother Charles and say, college would be nice, but I'd like to end up a Jew. And my sponsor, the sponsor that you know, I don't know about you, but I go from like poke 'em in the chest sponsors to I love you sponsors, you know, like, and I alternate one and Paul was a loving, and then the next guy poked me in the chest a lot, you know, and then. And somewhere in the middle, around 10, 12 years, I had a sponsor, and a guy named Howard P. that used to just say, you know, like, just, it's all about the second step and the 11th step. And it's, of course, it's not all about that. It's all about all the steps. If I don't stay sober, it doesn't matter if I'm into the second step, but I drink a little. No, of course. It's one day at a time, of course, it's important. But, you know, it's all these principles. And so there I was, and I you know, I've been seeking. And I mean, when I got sober, my first attempt at a power greater than myself was me and Paul. I got that. I'm me. Paul's not me. So me and Paul together are power greater than me. But that's not going to get me through the night 7 years later when I'm acting despicably. Or when I'm just filled with fear and I haven't had a drink in 11 years, 5 years, 2 weeks. It's going to have to build. It's going to have to change. Whatever it is, even if I'm floating down the road, this is the day I have. Somewhere along the line, I was sitting in a meeting. A guy said, when's the one time you can have conscious contact with God? Right? That's what we're seeking in the 11th step is conscious contact with God. When's the one time you can have conscious contact with God? And I'm thinking, when you're working with someone you don't like, when you're cleaning up cigarette butts and you don't smoke, when you're folding a chair you didn't sit in, when is the one time you can have conscious contact with God? Right now. So it doesn't matter that I prayed 2 hours ago. It doesn't matter that I went to synagogue on Saturday. It doesn't matter that I worked with a newcomer or didn't, or drove here or yelled or didn't yell, changed that extra diaper or didn't. Right now, there's no pressure. There's no bank account. We like that, right? Deposits. Look, I will say this. I'm not a big got up at the who's sober longer. 30 years. I'll take thick, dirty, leaf, branch-filled ice over thin, high-quality, clear ice any day. Right? If I've got to stand on a lake, give me thick, dirty ice. Like 20 feet thick rather than high-quality, best ice in the world, but it's only an inch thick. Right? I want every one of my 30 days. I mean, my 30 years. I want every minute of that time. I need every minute of that time. But what we're talking about today and this idea of one day at a time is this is the only day I have to work with. You know, I've had an amazing year, but it's just an amazing year. I've had some horrible years. You know, I've had some great days, some horrible days. You know, these things get kind of crazy too. You know, we're all gathered together. My wife keeps saying, like, well, what are we going to do? I'm like, well, we're doing it. We're walking back to the hotel. Now we're walking back to the convention center. There isn't much we can do, right? I mean, we're not going to be having, like, technical talks, you know? Like, what's the physics of this baby? No, we're doing it. We're drinking coffee. We're not drinking alcohol. And we're walking around in circles. This is pretty much, this is as good as it gets for us as a group, but for us as a group, this is pretty good. I mean, you know, this, you really see that we're not people who would normally mix. Right? I see it anyway. Yes, this is the only day we have. And treat this day well, and you will have the most amazing life. You know, this thing has grown and changed for me 1,000 times. First time I read the book, I was like, so glad it was not about God. It was about drinking and alcohol. Several years later, I read the book, and I was so glad it was about God. It wasn't all about alcohol. And I want to discount that. I drank for 7 years. I didn't think on the 14th that I could stay sober for the entire day, nor on the 15th, early on in this run, I said, at 90 days, I'm going back out. It better be a lot better at 90 days. And I think it was like 6 months before I remembered that I had said that. Brain damage can help. It's not always a bad thing. And, you know, and as I've been all the different things that I've been in, the places that I've lived, and, you know, and the things that I've pursued, you know, I just closed this off-Broadway play that was supposed to run for 8 weeks and ran for 8 months. You know, that was an amazing run. I mean, it's only that I'm here because it closed, you know. They wrote me and they said, we'd like you to speak at the conference. I don't know about these guys. I wanted to do this since the day I heard this happened. Tammy just told me that we're only doing this once in our entire lives. I don't think that's fair. I want the Alamo Dome. I got knocked out on a room. I got knocked out in room 103. That's just not fair. You know, so it's a, but I'm only here because the show closed. So the good comes with the bad comes with the good. When they wrote me, that's what I started to tell you. When they wrote me, they said, we'd like you to speak Saturday, 11 o'clock. I'm an Orthodox Jew. I can't use this microphone at 11 o'clock on Saturday. Just can't do it. I know. I'm with you. We say yes. Absolutely. We say yes. But I got to know when there's 75,000 people at a conference, they might be able to find someone else. So I said, I'm incredibly honored. It is an honor and a privilege for me to participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's an honor because of the life I have. It's because of you. Because of this. Because of Bill and Bob and God and Clancy. It is. And 2, 1, okay. And all the men that Clancy sponsored that sponsored me. And yet I had to say no. And it's an honor, and I want to say that. And it's a privilege. Why is it a privilege? What do I tag that to? Dr. Silkworth talks about Bill coming to him and asking him for the privilege of sharing his story with other alcoholics. And you know what Dr. Silkworth said? We begrudgingly consented. In other words, we didn't think it was a good idea, but we figured, how much harm could he do? And here we sit. And here we sit. Because they said, let's take a chance on this. And Alcoholics Anonymous started on June 10th, 1935. But Bill was sober some months before that. Right? So we don't mark it from Bill's sobriety date, from an individual sobriety date. We mark it from the two. The two began the process. When the second person got sober. I don't know what that means, and I can't really think because I'm a little overcharged right now, but there's something incredibly powerful about that. Again, I don't know what it is, but it's there. And I told them, thank you, I'm honored, but I can't do it. And they wrote back and said, well, do it now. And then I said, room? That's how fast it changes. I'm humble, I'm honored, I'm proud to be a part of, and then I'm just ego-driven in a second. So I don't want to take up any more of Tammy or Clayton's time. If they don't use their full 20 minutes, I'll be back. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm really glad he got stuck with a room, though. You know? Just tell him thank you again. And next we'll have my new friend Tammy from Colorado.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Tammy Reynolds, and I am an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is October 4th of 1998. My home group is It's in the Book. We meet at 6:30 on Wednesday evenings at Littleton Hospital in Littleton, Colorado. And I'm already getting choked up. It is absolutely an honor and a privilege to be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and to stand before you today and get to share just a little bit about me, my experience, strength, and hope. I was in the shower this morning, and I've been thinking about this one day at a time since February. this topic and everything, yesterday I'm like, okay, so what am I going to get up there and say? Should I write a note card? What am I going to do? And it's been racing through my head. So finally last night my husband looked at me and he said, just stop, just relax, and you know, remember God, he's going to like walk you through this. I'm like, so I'm going to read to you just a little bit, and I hate when people read from the mic, but I have to get focused because this program truly saved my life, and it's given me a life today beyond anything I could have ever imagined. And before I even read this, I just want to get a show of hands of how many people that this is their first international. Wow. Welcome. This is an incredible experience, and I hope that you're going to be at the Alamo Dome tonight and join in the Serenity Prayer, the Lord's Prayer, or any of the prayers. It's just an amazing experience. Okay. So, in As Bill Sees It, one of our pieces of literature, it says, the idea of 24-hour living applies primarily to the emotional life of the individual. Emotionally speaking, we must not live in yesterday nor in tomorrow. And then I'm going to skip to the bottom. Nothing is truer for us of AA than the biblical saying, faith without works is dead. AA services, all designed to make more better 12-step work possible, are the works that ensure our life and growth by preventing anarchy or stagnation. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no idea what to expect. I didn't know who I was or what I was. All I knew is that my life was a mess and that I needed something. I needed a way out and I needed a solution to my problem. All of my problems, actually. I was very scared. I was very shameful. And I needed to know how to live because I didn't know how. I have no idea when I picked up my first drink of alcohol. I grew up in a house where alcohol was just present. I remember my mother used to take bourbon and put it on cotton balls when I was teething. And I can remember sucking the bourbon out of the cotton ball and loving the flavor and the taste. And more than that, loving the effect that I had in my mouth and the way that it felt when it went down my throat. I made it through high school by the skin of my teeth. Every day was a day that I was thinking, planning, manipulating, lying, cheating, stealing, trying to figure out how I was going to get booze. And I did that for several years. I was very fortunate to get sober at the age of 24. At that time, I had already gotten married, and I had a 3-year-old daughter. Because I had a child, and because I had lost, and because I had lost everything that meant anything to me in my life, I was really willing when I got here to do whatever you guys told me to do. And I'm very grateful for that. I'm very grateful for that gift of desperation and that being at that jumping off place that it talks about in our literature. It talks about in the big book. It talks about being in that place where we're out of plans, we're out of ideas. I had no idea, like I said, what to expect when I got to AA, and I got so much more. This idea of one day at a time to me when I was brand new was completely and utterly just, I couldn't even imagine it. I mean, I was constantly either dwelling on the past or looking towards the future and how, you know, when I was new, I wanted everybody to be okay. I wanted everybody just to, you know, I was like, I am that story of, you know, ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing. I came out of that cyclone cellar and said, all right, everybody, I'm back, you know, and wanted everybody to just be all right. And you know what it took? It was a long period of reconstruction. It took a long time to get people to trust me again and to, you know, want me in their lives and to allow me to be in people's lives. I love what this reading that Bill had wrote, because I think that I stand before you and I have 11 years of sobriety, and I didn't think I was going to live past 25 ever. I had no idea that I was going to live past the age of 25, and to be standing before you and to have this much sobriety and to have the solution to our problem and to be able to carry that to other alcoholics is just an amazing gift. It talked about the emotional piece of it and that we try and stay present. We try and stay in today. And when I was new, there was no way I was doing that. But it was a good practice to try and stay focused and try not to reflect too much on what was going to happen. I had a sponsor very early in my sobriety that I felt very fortunate of having. She was armed with the facts about herself, and she could help me figure out who I was and what I was. I already shared that. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no idea. I didn't know if I was alcoholic or not. And I feel very fortunate that I sat down with the woman that was willing to help me figure that out. I think that that's one of the things that we do here. We just automatically assume that when people walk through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous that they're alcoholic. Guess what? They're not always alcoholic. It's our job to help them figure that out if we're properly armed with the facts about ourselves. And if you're not, I suggest you find somebody that is, that can help you see and figure out who and what you are, just like what was done with me. I sat down with that woman and I read page by page, word by word, out of the first 164 pages of the Big Book. And she showed me precisely how we have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. She helped me to get to the truth about who I was and what I was and what that looked like for me and why I needed a power greater than me that was going to relieve me of my alcoholism. Because, see, if I don't know what I'm powerless over, I don't need a power greater than me. I'm waiting for something to come here. Oh, my heart was about ready to pounce out of my chest when I was sitting over there, so I'm actually doing a lot better now. And I'm going to be going to take a nap way after this. So. Today my life is so rich and so full, and I just want to say thank you for all my friends that are here today. Not that all of you aren't my friends, but the people that actually know me and deal with me on a day-to-day basis or even a week-to-week or a month-to-month basis and put up with me. It means so much to me. And this whole idea of daily living really for me today lies in 10, 11, and 12. And I got to read this piece about the faith without works is dead. And for me today, that is the 12th step, and that is carrying the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And a lot of times the alcoholic who still suffers isn't the person that's brand new that walks through the doors. It can be the person that's got 5, 10, 15, how many ever years. I think it's been my experience that throughout my sobriety I suffer at different points and at different levels, and I always need help. There's just sometimes I need a little less help and a little less support than others, and there's some times when I really need a lot of support, and I'm picking up that phone, and I'm making those phone calls, and I'm reaching out to my fellows. And then there's those times that I'm the one on the other end of the receiver, and I'm answering all those phone calls. And my experience with this 12-step has been that of many different varieties. When I got sober, I'll just tell you a quick kind of funny story. At least I think it's kind of funny. I was 6 days sober, and I was in a meeting. It was a large speaker meeting. Okay, not as large as this one. It was like 250 people. And these people asked me to do a service position. They asked me if I would be the bell ringer. And what my job was to run around this meeting because everybody was outside smoking. And it was in Southern California. And in between the introductions and all the birthdays, there was a break. And so I had to go out and corral everybody back in after the break with my bell to try and get them back into the meeting. And when they asked me to do this, I was like, really? You want me to what? And I said yes, because I was told that I should never turn down an AA request. And I was... And this is when I was new. Later since, I've learned in after a few years that sometimes there are occasions where I have to say no, or I have to say thank you so much for asking, but here, let me find someone, help you find someone else. Anyways, that saying yes to that one service position lined me up for a whole experience within Alcoholics Anonymous that has taught me how to play better with others, not necessarily well, because when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I sure as heck didn't. I did not play well with others, and today I'm getting better at that. You guys have allowed me to serve you in different capacities. One of my favorite was being a GSR, being that communication link between the General Service Office, our Area 10, our district, and then the group. And being that link of communication. And it was so important to me and to my sobriety to always have been accountable to not only to individuals, but to a group. I, too, believe in having a home group. I believe that this idea of one day at a time is great, but I do need to start planning for my future. And if I plan to get sober and stay sober, taking these commitments and saying yes, it's okay. It will be okay. And when I can't show up for a commitment, that I call and let somebody know, and that I am accountable, and that I am responsible. Because, see, when I got here, I wasn't responsible. I wasn't accountable to anybody. I didn't care about anybody or anything. All I cared about was me. So for me to do that today, it shows that I do care, that I am responsible, that I do want to be, I want to be a woman of integrity today. I want to be a woman of integrity today. And for me, that is what integrity is. It's living a responsible, accountable life. And I am accountable to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm accountable to my group still to this day. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It has... I love all the people. I am so excited to be here. 6 minutes though? Okay. I cannot believe that I was asked to speak. I was like, really? Seriously? Me? Really? I think that it is an honor and a privilege to be able to share all the things that were the deepest, darkest, nastiest, yuckiest things about me have now turned them so that they have now transformed into assets, because as the result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I get to share those with other individuals today and hope that they get to have the same experience that I've had here. I think that it is so important that I don't become stagnant in this thing. It talked about that too in the reading. It talked about stagnation. And I think that I got to continue to show up, not just as a meeting maker. You know, I don't get to just go to meetings today. I get to be actively involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. That means that I'm sponsoring women, that when they're asking for sponsors, and that when there are women that come to my group, or when I'm at other meetings also, if there are women that come in, I go and I introduce myself. If they seem lost, or if they seem like they're wanting what we have, I make sure that I give them my phone number. You know, I mean, it's not that they're going to call, because they sure as heck probably won't. I also make myself available at my local central office or intergroup to do 12-step calls. And nothing is better, from my experience, than to go talk to a woman in a hospital bed and then get to see her take her one-year chip. And get this thing and see the spiritual awakening happen for them and get to experience what we experience and get to see the light come on in their eyes and the miracle of this program happen. I can't imagine not being a part of that, not wanting to carry this message and have those experiences. Today I have purpose. Today I have the ability to help another person through the toughest parts of my life. I can help people through that now because I have experience with what they're experiencing. And I've got to experience many things as a result of being a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I talk about being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm talking about being a member of this deal, actively participating in Alcoholics Anonymous, not just showing up late, you know, getting my chips and taking off. And not reaching out and helping or making coffee or folding the chairs or doing whatever it is that I can do to help this thing survive. Because this thing helped me to a life today that I can't ever repay. But I'm going to keep trying to repay what you guys have given me. Thank you so much for being here. And I hope you guys have an incredible time.
Thank you so much, Tammy. I thought she did a great job. Our next speaker is Clayton from British Columbia.
Hi, I'm Clayton. I'm an alcoholic. Wow, and everybody stuck to their. There's a lot of time. Israel, you should have had my spot here. There's a lot of time to go through. I'm thrilled to be here. This is really really interesting, and yeah, it's been one day at a time for me too since about February. So an apt topic to go through. I had supper, Father's Day a little while with my son. He's 26 years old, Adrian. I said, I'm coming to the international conference in San Antonio and they asked me to speak. He says, wow, Dad. He says, I knew you had a lot of trouble with alcohol and your story's pretty bad, but that bad? That you're like, they want you to talk to the whole convention? My God. I didn't tell him they drew my name out of a hat from a bunch of us and, So But that's the reality of it. I mean, you know, I am here, and I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 14 years sober. My home group is in White Rock, British Columbia, just south of Vancouver. And, you know, my story is I grew up in an upper middle class family in a small town in the interior of British Columbia. We had a good family, three brothers. We had a summer cabin and a boat, and my dad was an insurance adjuster, my mom was an alderman, and you know, things looked really good on the outside, but at home, you know, my dad drank a lot. I don't know if he was alcoholic or not. In the end, he tapered off and he never came to Alcoholics Anonymous and didn't quit, but I knew when there was trouble at home, the vacuum cleaner was going, and my mom was busy cleaning, and she was mad, and I stopped going home. I would go to the pool hall instead of going home, and started hanging around the school fence, smoking, and just not, you know, I excelled I was good in academics. I was good in sports. But I think I didn't quite fit in like a lot of us. I just didn't feel like I fit in, and I tried to excel in other areas to try and make up for it. Water skiing, I didn't go home. I water skied all day long, so I became really good at that. I was a Canadian champion water skier. I was snow skier. Of course, in the interior of British Columbia, I have some great ski hills, and I was getting up the ladder, getting close to the Olympic team on the for skiing back in the late 60s, I guess. And until I was about 16, and I discovered lemon gin. And whatever else I could get, you know, ease that sense of discomfort. And I started to feel a part of. And so for many years, I just, you know, that's what became my life. And all that other sports, the academics, I graduated, but the sports fell off, and my hair grew long, and I went to university and became a radical student at one of our universities up there. And I got either A's or I got F's, right? If I was into it, I was into it. If I didn't like it, I didn't like it. And I ended up, let's go back here to make some notes to make sure Yeah, so for many years I partied and drank and didn't quite make it through the university. I went to a technical school, got an engineering degree, and did well, got a high-paying job out of there. Worked estimating million-dollar construction projects during the week and running a punk rock nightclub on the weekends. And we had a great time. That was the only time I got arrested. The police busted our club. They didn't like us in downtown Eastside in Vancouver, and they arrested me as one of the ringleaders of this underage. There was like 200 kids in a club licensed for 70, with majority of them underage. And I was such an affront. I was so, how could you possibly? They arrested 10 of us, I think, and threw us in jail for the night for being drunk in a public place. I hadn't even started, you know. I had to, you know. So we complained to the police department and the city hall, and I was up in front of city council, and they're going to take the license away, and it was a big, anything to cause a ruckus, anything, I was always feeling like I was, you know, things were being taken away from me, and I had to grab onto stuff all the time, and it's a lot of work when you're trying to run the world, and you feel like you're not getting your fair shake, no matter what, right? So the alcohol solved that problem. I really believe without alcohol, I don't think I would have made it. You know, I think that alcohol saved me from feeling so too alienated to make it. You know, and it, so it bought me a lot of time. I lost a few jobs, I was working. I was out of work, and Dad said, why don't you come up and be an insurance adjuster in the interior back home? And I said, oh, well, I'll come in and help you for the summer. And I went up and I thought, well, this is a good gig because you get paid well and no one's bossing you around. But I'm not, you know, I don't want to go home back to the small town single. So I asked this girl who I knew to move in with me and go up there. So she moved in, but I drank a lot, and of course, and I'm in the bar all the time, and she's not drinking that much, and things are starting to fall apart a little bit. So I said, well, we should get married, you know. And so she said, okay, and we got married, and a couple years later, we were things were falling apart still, and so we had a kid, right? And about 3 years later, she says to me, you're an alcoholic. And I went, I was dumbfounded. I go, what, how could I be alcoholic? What are you talking about? She says, you're an alcoholic. And, you know, we owned the house. I was flying all around the province. I was doing all this work. And how could I possibly be alcoholic? What's wrong with you? And I thought it was postpartum depression or something. I mean, 3 years is a little long to go on with that. But, and I went to the doctor, and I said, well, you know, this is what's going on. And he says, yeah, you seem like a really nice guy, but I don't know about her, you know. And so even he bought into it, you know, and it's that we have a way of making things work, right? And so I went to the hospital there. They had an alcohol counselor or something there, and I remember he gave me a list of questions to answer. And so I answered them as honestly as I thought they should be answered, and the... And they said, you're a heavy social drinker. And I said, see, you know, and she said, baloney, you're, well, it's a little stronger than baloney, but you're an alcoholic and we're leaving. And I had no, I said, and I, you know, that day they left, it was in December, and Adrian was 3 years old. And I remember taking him down this, we had a sled, well, it was a wintertime in Prince George in the interior of British Columbia. It's wintry and snowy, and we had a husky dog and a sled, and took him down the road for a sled ride and back up and put him in the car. I still remember that vividly, shutting the door on the car, and they drove away. And I had no idea what was wrong, absolutely none. And they drove off, and I went back in that house, that empty house. Anyone's been there? The echo when the furniture's gone? It's really memorable. And I just kept drinking, and I didn't know what to do, so I left. I took the company car and went to Vegas. That's where I need to go. And I stopped to see a friend on the way, and I told him, we met in the bar, and I told him what was going on, and I started to tear up. I started to get choked up about my wife and kid leaving, and he said, geez, Clayton, you know, settle, have a drink. And I remember drinking a mug of beer and pushing all that stuff down, and off I went. And so I drank, you know, for another seven, eight years, and spiraled. It got progressively worse, right? When we separated, she wanted in the separation agreement that I would not get custody of Adrian if something happened to her, if she died or something, I would normally the other parent would get custody, and she wanted me not to get custody because she said, you're going to end up on Skid Row. That's ridiculous. How could I end up in Skid Row? I got transferred eventually to Vancouver. There was a mutiny in the office where I was managing, you can imagine, right? Single, drinking, just life out of control. And anyway, they transferred me to Vancouver, and I lost my train there. But I was making, you know, this is in the 90s or 1990, and I'm making $60,000 a year, got a company car, wear a suit during the day. I live in a shared house with about five other people. I've got a mattress on the floor with a borrowed dresser. That's all I can pull together, and I have no idea what's going on. I'm going, waking up in the mornings, I'm looking at my Visa receipts to find out where I've been the night before. I go to the cash machine. I am terrified. I have no idea what, if anything, is in the bank account. I had no money. All my change was gone. I have no cigarettes. I'm down on Granville Street in Vancouver bumming cigarettes. I kept going. I did get rescued at one point here. How much time do I have? I was in the insurance business still, and every year we have a yearly party where they give away wine, and
and the draw is wine bottles. So I go every year, and I'm hoping to win the wine. One year we go there, and there's a fruit basket. And I go, what the hell is with this fruit basket, and who is in charge of prizes this year? And there's this woman in charge of prizes, and she doesn't drink. And I go, what the hell's with the fruit basket? This is ridiculous. I'm out of here. And I stomp out of the meeting, out of this thing, and I go to the bar. I'm going to the bar to watch the hockey game. And I'm Canadian, eh? And and this girl follows me to the bar. And, of course, she lives in White Rock, and she's got a house and a couple kids. And I'm living in this terrible place, in this French. And she thinks I'm wonderful, and she takes me out to White Rock, and now I'm living in White Rock in this nice house with a couple of kids who hate me, right? And, and we just fought and fought, and our lifestyle was just fighting. And which is saying, the horns on my head fit the holes in her head, right? It was, so she was a good Al-Anon candidate, and a star candidate, and should I judge her? And she says at one point, so a few years together, we're going skiing, and in the back of the car, we're jam-packed. There's two kids, all the ski equipment, and I've got two cases of beer, a box of wine, and a bag of scotch and miscellaneous bottles. And the kids are in the back. They're going, you're an alcoholic, you're an alcoholic. Jesus, we're just going skiing. Come on, you know, you got to take some booze. And but this kept ringing in my head, you know, and I knew my insurance job had fizzled by that time. Downsizing, they said, and the guy with that big expense account and very little production is the guy that's going to go. So I started a .com business. I thought I would get in on this new thing. And had an office downtown, and I'm living there. I'm working there and driving back and forth. And it's about a half-hour drive home. And so I would work, you know, have three beers downtown, a couple of beers in the car, get home, have my wine. And that's how I'm managing my alcoholism. I'm a daily drinker. But I'm managing, you know, and unless I get those four drinks or five in the downtown, and then all bets are off. And, you know, and a few nights I drove home in a blackout. I don't recall how I wake up in the morning. I have no idea how I got home, where the car is or what. And I wake up and I look out in the garage and there's the car, and I'm going, you know, this is getting bad. You know, like I'd promised a lot of people that I wouldn't drink and drive. Oh, yeah, I won't drink and drive. Oh, yeah. But I never really meant it. You know, I won't drink and drive when I'm really bad. This time I've made a promise to myself that I will not drink and drive again. And I was serious about it. And a week later, you know, I drank and drove again. I don't recall coming home. And that's when one of my first kind of the light starts to go on a little bit. I'm going, Jesus, you know, that's what is that thing that's making me do that? And a little while later, we went to a New Year's Eve party. Actually, I celebrated up February 10th, 96, just a little after Israeli. And February. I think February 4th was his date. And I went to a New Year's Eve party, and I took the near beer with me. I'm not going to drink. I'm just going to drink near beer. And hey, you know what? I haven't even started recovery. I'm still drunk here. Anyway, I drank near beer till, you know, it's getting close to midnight. Someone said, "Do you want a shooter?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll have a shooter." You know, and I've been really good. So I have one shooter, and I have another shooter, and then pretty soon everyone's out in the living room doing Happy New Year, and I'm in the kitchen hammering shooters, and I'm in a blackout again. You know, I wake up in the morning, and we've been in a hot tub with other women. It's not, you know, just it's been awful. It's been, and I don't know what's happened, and I'm afraid. You know, this fear comes over me again. And what the hell happened? You know, and how do I end up there? Anyway, this woman said, "You're an alcoholic." And I said, "No, I'm not. I'll go for testing," you know. And so same thing. We went to the wellness center in White Rock, and they said, "You're a heavy social drinker." I said, "See?" And And that relationship spiraled out of control, and she was off with some other guy, and I was off. And anyway, I ended up living in this office downtown, and that was at my bottom. And I was living on the couch. I remember going outside in the morning because I had to move my car to keep the parking thing. There's some cops looking at me, and I'm looking at them, and I could tell they're going to shake me down, you know. And I'm thinking, oh, you know, what am I going to do? I can't pay the rent. I go up, and I'm walking up, you know, that lonely walk up the street alone, and there's a bar that's not open yet. I'm thinking of killing myself. I'm thinking this is ridiculous, you know, or I'm going to go to Skid Row. You know, and I'm thinking, well, somebody once said, you're going to end up on Skid Row, right? And, well, it wasn't quite Skid Row. This hotel was about a block or two away. It was a blues club. I thought, oh, no, I'm there for the music. But a room with a light bulb was all I wanted. Then I could drink. No one's going to bug me, and that's all I want. But I got this kid, right? I got this boy, and I wasn't raised that way. You know, what a legacy to leave, you know. And I think I'll try and sober, quit drinking one more time. Alcohol isn't my problem, but it's not helping. And if I've sobered up before. I've quit drinking before. It didn't help. In fact, I got miserable. People didn't like me. I got tense. They'd just say, Jesus, Clayton, have a drink, man. You know, but I'll try one more time and see what happens. So I went to a friend. Eventually I got to my first AA meeting. From my very first meeting, I stayed sober. I got the penny drop. Well, it didn't really drop. I still wasn't an alcoholic. They say you get alcoholism through the ears, right? And that's what happened to me. I just heard some great talks. A guy from jail. You know, it looked like an Amway meeting. Everyone's all happy. And I'm an alcoholic. But I heard this guy from jail talk, saying how great the program was, and he doesn't go to jail anymore. And I didn't think a guy from jail would lie. You know, he didn't really have a lot to... There's nothing in it for him to start lying about that, I didn't think, and I don't know why I thought that, but I started going to meetings, and I started to sober up, and I started to get involved really right away. White Rock is great for AA. There's like five meetings a day. It's a small town, but good sobriety. I started to read the book, do the literature, try to figure this thing out, and the only part, I got up to the God part. I liked everything except for this God thing, But I knew I couldn't leave until I was going to leave, and I thought there was only one thing I haven't done is this higher power thing. What the hell is that? And I really can't leave until I've, you know, really done the programs. Then I can say, you guys are a bunch of idiots. I'm out of here, right? And so that's when I started to work on that, on the God concept. I looked at these birds flying, you know, like those. They fly in those groups, and these do all, in unison. They're flying, and around that area, there's quite large fields where they fly. And my God, how does that happen? You know, and I thought, well, maybe it looks like there's a high, kind of a higher power directing that bird flock to do, you know, to fly like that. And I worked, you know, slowly with that, slowly but surely, I worked with that concept. And 2 minutes? I don't know. I couldn't pay my rent. They said turn it over. You know, I said, oh, okay, I'll turn that over and see if my rent gets paid. You know, and I was walking up the street. I turned it over, and the next thought that came to my head was, you know what? There's one file, one company I haven't billed yet for that work that I did for them. I think I'll send the bill out. Sure enough, I sent the bill, got the money in, and paid the rent. You know, it's amazing how that worked. The amends. So Adrian, I started doing the steps and all that, and I got it up to everything. Everywhere up to, I'm not going to make amends to my ex-wife because she left with my kid. And, of course, that was totally unjustified. Why would you do that? But one day she phoned me and she said, I wish you were dead. I thought, ooh. And I'm in the program, and I think my buddies would appreciate, you know, that's not what we like to hear about each other. That I better trust you what I can do. And they said, don't say you're sorry. You know, I thought, oh, what am I going to do? What I did was wrote a letter out acknowledging her. Because I had dismissed her all the way. That's what I did to her. I dismissed everything that she did. Even though she granted me access and I begrudgingly paid my support. Everything, you know, it was just a dismissive never. And so I wrote, I acknowledged her. I said, "You're right." That's how I started off. "You're right. I am an alcoholic." And you're right. I did almost end up on Skid Row, you know. And you've done a great job of raising Adrian. You've taken him and you went to school and you gave me access. And she became a respiratory technician. And so thank you. And he saved Adrian from living in an alcoholic home, you know. And I put that in an envelope. And I said, "If there's anything I can do, you know, let me know. And more I can do, let me know." And I put an envelope, slid it under her door, and then I waited. We're still arguing over some braces. It was why she wanted me dead. She had dental coverage. I didn't have any. Adrian, so she said, "You didn't mean anything you said in that letter." And I thought, great. She read the letter. I knew that. And I'd made my amends. And, you know, and from that day on, started to become friends again, you know, in a different way. We never got back together, but we became friends and supportive and have co-raised Adrian together, you know, and it's been fabulous. She's been, Adrian's work turned out really well. He's only totaled 2 cars so far. And I don't think he's got a problem. One day at a time. Am I off? Are we off? Do you want to leave? Okay. I'll just finish with one story here about my lifelong dream. I did a lot of sailing while drinking, because you can drink when you're out in the water and you're not likely to get caught. And so I raced. I became racing was racing boats, my big thing was my dream was to do the Victoria to Maui sailboat race. And I got on with this crew. There was 10 guys on this boat. And of course, while I was drinking, I always thought about this race. I always wanted to have a beer on the Lahaina Yacht Club deck, right? I could just picture this thing, this deck with the sun shining, all these sailors, and having a beer. And you just sail the ocean. How great would that be? And so the 10 of us got on a boat, and it was no drinking. But I was in charge of planning the halfway party, which was they wanted scotch or rum for the halfway party. So Clayton, you go get some rum. They don't know I'm an alcoholic. This is a almost professional thing. And so I bought 2 40-ouncers. There's 10 people. I don't drink. There's 9. I'm thinking that should cover it. You know, 10 ounces each or something. But I'm worried about it because I'm out in the middle of the ocean. I don't have any support. And what's going to happen? And I'm, first of all, just going to the liquor store and getting 2 40s was an experience. I hadn't been in there for a while. And then planning this party, and I poured these drinks and for these guys halfway. We had to wait a couple of days because it was too windy to even have a party. One day it lightened up a bit, and we drank. They drank, and they didn't even finish the 40s. I couldn't believe it. I was astounded. You know, and they said, and the drinks were really strong. They were complaining about how strong I'd made the drinks, you know. But one day at a time, which is what this is about, and these are one of the experiences where one day I had no idea how I was going to face that situation. You know, and it was really one day at a time. I knew the day was coming. I just trusted God I would get through it, and I did. You know, and we got to Lahaina. They had a big champagne thing, squirting champagne over everybody, and I stood aside and felt sorry for myself for, you know, a couple minutes. And then you know what? Then they left. They went off and had dinner, and we all, as did we all, right? And my wife, Christine, was there, and we had a great time. So it was all good. Just one other thing. I should shut up since everybody else had their 20 minutes. So, okay, thank you very much, and I appreciate being here.
Hi, everybody. I'm Shirley, and I'm an alcoholic. And I neglected to say it earlier, but they allowed me a little time here at the end to say that my home group is the Greater Kearns Group, and we're located in Salt Lake City, Utah. Meet at Monday nights at 8 o'clock, and you're welcome to charge on out. My sobriety date is April 15th, 1986, and I hope you all think of me as you put that special mail in the piece of mail in the mailbox on April 15th, and I've had some folks ask me, it's like, why would you pick that day to sober up? And I was like, oh, why not? You know? I know that for me, this truly is a one-day-at-a-time program. And I can bring that back to the very time when I first got sober, because on April 14th, 1986, I'm sure there was no way I could have gotten sober. I couldn't have. I didn't even think about it. On April 16th, 1986, I don't think I could have gotten sober. What happened was, on the 15th of April, I was given God's grace for just long enough not to take a drink that morning. And from that time on, one day at a time, I haven't had to pick up a drink. And life has been absolutely fantastic since then. Our speakers brought up a couple of things that really hit home to me. And one was when, you know, we're asked to be of service, we are of service when we can. And I know when I first came here and I first found a group that I decided to call a home group, because everybody said that they were... This group, they had like these secret meetings. They weren't like held at the time of the meeting. They were held some other time away from there at somebody's house. And they called it a home group meeting, business meeting. And nobody invited me. You know, they said this is for home group members only. And I wasn't one. And I thought, well, I know they're doing something there, you know, that they're keeping from me. So I went there to the first one that I remember. And the guy whose house it was, his name was John, and he comes to the door, and he said, "You're not a home group member." And I said, "Well, no, I'm not." And he says, "Well, do you want to be?" And I'm this big old gruff guy, and I said, "Well, yeah." And he said, "Well, then come on in." You know, and it was like, oh, that's what it took. You know, that's as much as it took. And this group was really active in service. They, you know, held a bunch of service positions, and they were just all into it. And I wanted so much to be a part of AA. I wanted to be in it and surrounded by it. And I was such a mess because I was still so new. And there was this guy named Chris that was at that meeting, and I asked Chris, I says, everybody's got a job. I want a job, you know. And he says, well, I have a job for you. I have a job that you can do. And I says, okay, what's my job? And he says, see that chair just inside the door? He says, your job is to sit in that chair every Monday night. Well, what kind of job is that? And for one thing, he didn't say that's the only job you can do, you know, which he could have, but he didn't. He said, your job is to be hope. He says, if somebody comes to that meeting once, you know, you're probably just sitting in that chair. If they come to that meeting twice, they'll look and say, I saw her sitting in that chair. Now come the next time and it's like, this deal must work. That's 3 weeks in a row. That same person's been in that chair. So my first service position got to be hope. And that's something I gained from meetings all the time. The second service position I got was we took turns washing cups because we didn't use styrofoam stuff. We still don't. We use regular cups. We wash them. And I'll tell you, it's a great job for a newcomer because I could not talk to people. I could not open a conversation. And if you're standing there stuck with your hands in the sink, people milling around you, they talk to you. And you have to answer back. And it was great for me. The other part is, if you're a newcomer and you're still kind of shaky, you can get that little agitation stuff going under the water and the cups get a little cleaner than maybe somebody that's got a little more time. So I became a part of that group. And then I became a part of something bigger, which was my city and my town and my area and my, you know, what a deal this is. I'm a part of the world of AA.